So let me first thank my collaborators. It's Anatoly Kukulov at College of Staten Island, Boris Svistunov from UMass Amherst, and Matthias Troyer from ETH. Okay, it's actually here. So that's more or less the summary of the talk. It's for a particular symmetry of the confined criticality. When you think about superfluid valence band solid transitions, and there are good arguments that the Ginzburg-Landau theory is very likely to be wrong. So you start doing models, model after model, model after model, you see that Ginzburg-Landau is right. So then you go to the DCP action as written, do the simulations, and you see that Ginzburg-Landau is still right, which means that the DCP action written for the superfluid valence bond solid transition is the theory, which is not in contradiction with Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson theory. We'll come to this. So I'm afraid that, well, part of my talk will be something I never did in the field, which means explaining what is DCP and why. That's not my work, but because I can start from the DCP action and tell you the properties of the DCP action itself, but
I'm just wondering what's the
difference. The confined critical point.
Okay.
So first I will just, well, basically introduce how the field started. Well, here's one of the authors. So how did the confined critical point was derived and under what considerations? Then I will try to say, okay, what naive people would think about this, the same problem using Ginzburg-Landau phenomenology, and how you would try to escape one of the traps which you see in describing superfluid solid transitions for quantum systems. And basically you'll see that, well, out of the difficulty which is present in this model, you have two escapes. One is that, well, you have to write down Ginzburg-Landau phenomenology, but you have to demand that the multi-component order parameter always has a finite modulus, never goes to zero. So if you demand this, you naturally come to the conclusion that superfluid solid transitions have to be first order in nature. They cannot happen as a continuous transition. Well, the other scenario, which is alternative to Ginzburg-Landau with fixed modulus, is to consider how certain type of crystals are destroyed by what type of defects, and actually arrive at the theory which is called the confined critical point. The deconfined critical point by itself is not yet the statement that you have a continuous phase transition. It's deriving the action for this transition. But whether this action actually is describing a continuous point or not, for a long time was actually unknown. It was kind of a speculation, why not? Well, and then I'll show you that, well, if you actually stop simulating models, because in any particular model you can be unlucky. You just see first order phase transition and so what? That's the property of a particular model. So you'd better just study properties of the deconfined critical action as written. And to check whether it's a self-consistent theory, which means the deconfined critical action is derived assuming it's a continuous point. Then you take the action and actually try to verify that this continuous point does exist in this action. So that's what I will try to describe, and I will first spend some time just trying to explain that, well, in certain type of models, you cannot be just naive in terms of doing the simulation, looking at the screen, and immediately claiming the answer. You have to analyze data pretty accurately to understand what's the true story. So this will be the discussion of numerical flowogram method. And then basically we'll show that, well, looks like it's, in our mind, it's a conclusive argument that in this action, actually, well, there is no deconfined critical point, which is continuous. So in this action, you always have first order phase transitions.
So this is for the U1
symmetry? It's U1 symmetry only, yes. I said already just from the very beginning. It's about liquid solid transitions, not about Niel valence bond solid. SU2 symmetry, that's something we do now, but I don't have the final answer yet. Anytime I can switch to the blackboard if there are answer questions. Simply, well, drawing those pictures on the blackboard will take time. So when we describe a superfluid solid transition, we basically can keep in mind the following model. The model can be pretty simple in terms of microscopic Hamiltonian. For example, well, to describe checkerboard solid, all you need is bosons hopping on the lattice. Suppose they are hardcore bosons, so two bosons do not occupy the same site, half filling in nearest neighbor repulsion. So if the nearest neighbor repulsion is strong enough, sooner or later bosons will arrange in the checkerboard solid. So basically, depending on the coupling between the bosons, you have two phases. One is superfluid. Superfluid means it's basically disordered. Well, it's a classical picture, of course, not a quantum picture. completely disordered structure of bosonic particles going around the lattice. If they form a solid, they break translation symmetry and form a checkerboard solid. That's a particular solid. There are many other solids which can exist in different bosonic models. For example, one of them is columnar valence bond solid, when bosons actually break translation symmetry by being localized on a bond. Of course, in the Hopping-Hamiltonian, boson is not sitting between the bond. It simply goes back and forth. In spin models, this will be a structure where you have a singlet on this bond, singlet on this bond, singlet on this bond. Again, well, it's a classical picture of singlets. There are also quantum fluctuations between them.
I mean here
that you break the density-density. The correlation function for density-density in the checkerboard solid has long range order.
The total density is fixed, yeah?
The total density is 1/2.
1/2. So yeah. Why this is not, that should be zero, not zero at any.
Well, of course you subtract 1/2. I'm just not mentioning this. Yeah. So I'm just saying, well, this correlation function, obviously, yeah, obviously.
And the same for a second.
Yeah, if necessary, yeah, sure. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I just mean that, well, there is long-range order in the corresponding function, which means if you have a constant, still you have diverging correlation length. Yeah, obviously, you have to subtract averages.
Well, he didn't say what it equals to.
So. You don't have to.
No.
It's a long-range order. So in this case, well, the long-range order will be in the momentum sector pi, and so on and so forth. Same here. Well, in this case, well, I can say, well, it's a density on a bond, but because the model is not defined, that boson can sit between the lattice points. It's probably current-current correlation function. But it doesn't matter. Just basically, the picture is self-explanatory. It just says the boson prefers to hop, or in spin language, this will be a singlet. This is very simple Hamiltonian. It's bosons with nearest neighbor repulsion. This is more complex Hamiltonian. And for example, you can get this phase. I can start from, okay. The first one you can obtain from very simple Hamiltonian, bi dega dj. The first term, then you couple. And if hardcore bosons, if they couple sufficiently strong, you get the checkerboard. Then you can add correlated hopping. For example, if you take, well, it's easy to draw. If you have a plaquette and two bosons occupy those corners of the plaquette, you have a matrix element to take those two bosons to the corners. Well, basically, this term promotes the two bosons, if they happen to be across the diagonal, to hop like this.
So is that K term, the ring exchange term, can I call it the same?
K is a matrix element to transfer this configuration
in
to this one.
In terms of M, it should be exponent or phi phi or something.
No, it's a Hamiltonian. It's a matrix element for two bosons which are in those corners, yeah, to go to those corners. It's a matrix element. Just like here, T is a, graphically, it's just boson hopping from one side to another.
Yeah.
So this is correlated hopping. Two bosons have to hop simultaneously. In spin language, this corresponds to ring exchange term.
If you would introduce the planar rotators in each point, that would be... this is the first term is the nearest neighbors, and this is not nearest.
This is four spin term.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why it's, well, in spin models, it's called ring exchange. Well, because basically you have here S minus, S minus, S plus doing this.
So K, people call K ring exchange. You both are numbers.
Whatever the name. It's a matrix element in a particular transformation. That's it. The name doesn't matter. So you can make this phase a stable ground state if you introduce this term and if it's sufficiently strong, but not too strong.
Did people really see this?
Yeah, well, that's the model which was simulated by Sandvik. He added the ring exchange term, and he got the valence bond solid.
But he mentioned to me that paper has some problem.
No, not in terms of Hamiltonian. The paper has no problem in identifying quantum phases. Quantum phases are there. The problem was with the transition type.
Oh, and
that's the subject of the story. But you can get this ground state. This is probably more difficult to get, but it's not so important. Well, you can Hamiltonians are probably even more difficult to design to get some of the faces. But if I go to the action, which means I just simply go to one higher dimension, because, well, numerically we do imaginary time. So if you actually write down the action, you can easily engineer in the path integral language the proper action, which can give you any of those solids that will. It's pretty easy engineering. You can easily write down a local model, which will have all the different solids as a possibility in the phase diagram.
But the Hamiltonian is homogeneous.
No, the Hamiltonian itself is homogeneous. It doesn't break the symmetry of the lattice. So when you form a solid, you break translation symmetry. So I'm not talking about Mott insulators. I have to have fractional filling, and I have to break the translation symmetry. The Hamiltonian is translation.
The Hamiltonian is invariant under the translation by one.
By one period, yeah. So that's why solid has to break translation symmetry. Mott insulators are not part of the discussion.
Spontaneous.
Yeah. And so basically the question is how it's possible to go from superfluid state to the solid state. Going to this one is pretty easy. Everybody would agree it's first order phase transition. And this can be easily controlled by the theory. But going from the superfluid to Wellens-Bond solid or Plaquette solid is more difficult. And it's not obvious how it you can do it. So let me discuss what...
What is this Plaquette solid in spin language?
Well, it means that, well, four spins on a Plaquette keep flipping. You form a singlet, but out of four spins. You don't have to form a singlet out of two spins, right? So you form a singlet out of four spins. And they behave as a neutral object, well, spin neutral object from this side. For bosons, it means, well, you simply you have two bosons running on a ring all over the place.
Four spins is one, something like that.
Yeah.
You can think of it as a resonating valence bond.
Yeah. So you just add a term. Well, you see, well, in the conventional valence bond, if I simply rotate those two, you lose some of the energy for this one. But if you add the proper compensation terms, it makes sense for those two to resonate very strongly. And then you just form a Plaquette. So two bosons run around the Plaquette.
Where is superfluid here?
Well, it's so simple that I didn't draw it because, well, superfluid is something disordered in terms of bosons. Any snapshot is a random position of particles. Another snapshot is another random position.
But there's no superfluid in this. If you had half filling, is there?
If this term is small and this term is small, it's superfluid. Okay. It's almost a weakly interacting Bose gas. Okay. So yeah, it has a limit of the weakly interacting Bose gas, which definitely has a superfluid state.
But it's the most trivial phase.
Well, okay, I understand.
And so the question is, well, how phase transition happen in this system?
You're looking at large V and K.
For sufficiently large V, you'll get this. For sufficiently large K, you can get this. Or if you add more sophisticated terms, you can go here. And the question is, what type of transitions you can get? Oh, well, the naive Ginzburg-Landau scheme would say that, well, I can describe superfluids by some complex number order parameter. I can describe checkerboard by conventional Ising magnetization order parameter, because I break Z2 symmetry. Well, I can describe Wellens-Bond solid, well, basically with two numbers. Each number separately is roughly the same as the checkerboard one, because in the Wellens-Bond solid, I have four-fold degeneracy. Because you can place this bond in X direction on this bond, or you can shift it by one. It's another ground state. Or you can rotate the whole picture and do Wellens-Bond solid in Y direction. So I have four different ground states. So Wellens-Bond solid has four-fold degeneracy in the ground state. This one is two-fold degeneracy.
To get this, in quantum color, get this Wellens-Bond solid, I can put a V equal to beta, just to look at the TK. Is that, I can put the nearest label V equal to beta, V.
What do you want from this term?
Yeah, if I set that to one vanish, then just look at the TK model.
I don't know.
So I could get this way.
Probably. Well, I have to look at the paper, but I don't remember by heart. I'm not sure, but probably even V is not necessary to get the Wellens-Bond solid. So while you have lots of, well, this is for Plaquette order parameters, and you can just keep writing. And basically, well, for different types of orders, you can write down order parameters as a function of some coupling constant in the Hamiltonian, whether it's V or K or some combination of them. And Ginzburg-Landau says, well, the possible scenarios are superfluidity vanishes at some point, and solid order starts at some other point. That's allowed. Or you have superfluidity and solid orders changing places in the first order phase transition. This would be the most natural probably scenario for many from the experience. But this is a kind of also okay for phenomenological ground. You can also have superfluidity vanishing at a point, but at this point you already have some solid order. So this would be a super solid, which means at the same time you have superfluidity and solid orders also allowed and can be observed. At least, well, in some models you can easily just see that, well, super solids do exist. And we know about them on a triangular lattice. On a square lattice, they phase separate, but it's a kind of separate issue of a particular Hamiltonian. By adding next nearest neighbor terms, you can stabilize supersolid on a square lattice as well. So this is also allowed. There is only one problem with all of this, is that, well, somewhere here, if you simply write down Naive-Ginzburg-Landau, you phase quantum disordered phase. Because here you say, well, in the ground, well, I'm talking only about the ground state, not finite temperature. In the ground state, you have none of the orders. The system is not liquid, the system is not solid. And I will try to present an argument. Maybe, well, my argument is not the most rigorous one, but sufficiently convincing.
What is on the...
Well, it's order parameter, whatever the order parameter. Well, because here it's superfluid order parameter, this is solid order parameter. So vertical axis is the order parameter.
And then this is a phase diagram in...
It's kind of a jargon, I would say.
This is coupling constant, and this is order parameter.
Axis for, yeah, it's not a phase, it's a kind of jargonic picture,
yeah.
Because one and the same axis is used for different order parameters.
Yeah. Well, that's why I just don't say, well, this is for the blue line, it's the order parameter referring to psi. For the yellow line, this is the order parameter which it refers to, I don't know, valence bond solid, for example. Well, basically, the phase diagram is, of course, the lower axis only. This is just telling you, okay, well, there is some finite value of the order parameter.
Just one control parameter.
Now, the problem here is that, well, you have quantum disordered phase. Mm-hmm. And if you start thinking, well, whether it's actually possible, you actually face the problem. And naive Ginzburg-Landau always starts, as a theory, from some state which has no orders, and then you start making perturbative expansion in order parameters. So having the green phase is actually, in the standard approach, is very important to have for the Ginzburg-Landau. Because you start writing an expansion in order parameters, so you assume there is something where all order parameters are zero, and from this phase you start building small order, say in superfluid, small order in terms of a solid. So the discussion of the green phase is very important for the standard Ginzburg-Landau. But the problem is it doesn't exist. And at least, well, people may have different arguments why it doesn't exist. We have one which is in terms of word lines. There is one wonderful relation which was derived by Pollock and Separly. It's the relation between superfluid density and so-called Whiting numbers. Whiting numbers simply tell you if this is space, this is imaginary time. Remember, we're talking about ground state. Imaginary time is as long as you want. Suppose you take some finite size system, reasonably finite, and imaginary time goes to infinity. So if you have your word lines, which look like spaghetti, there is no anything telling you about the structure, how to organize those word lines. So the local number of those word lines, the density has fluctuations, and you cannot trace a particular word line whether it's wrong or right in this particular place. There is no marker telling you that some of the word line is a foreign body locally. So it's a spaghetti.
Word lines for your initial systems, I don't understand.
No, they are word lines where they are particle trajectories in imaginary time. It's conventional path integral.
It's real particles.
No, real particles, real bosons propagating on a lattice.
Real bosons propagating in
imaginary time. Real bosons propagating in imaginary time. It's a path integral.
Feynman's integrals for a statistical operator when you represent statistical partition function for Gibbs distribution in terms of Feynman's patterns, you get this picture.
So they are word lines.
It's a mapping of bosons onto polymers in D plus one. So the statistics of bosons in D dimensions is equivalent to statistics of polymers in D plus one.
Yeah.
Well, you can think about real time if you like, and then replace real time with imaginary one. You'll have particle trajectories, and your answer is to sum over all possible trajectories which you see on the screen.
Yeah.
So that's conventional quantum mechanics.
You speak about zero temperature. Or
zero temperature. Zero temperature.
Zero temperature. Then your time is real.
Time goes up, 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 and up. Well, depends what you want. If you study statistical mechanics, your time is imaginary because the, yeah. you look at the particle propagator.
Statistical mechanics, no questions.
That's what I'm saying. Well, I'm looking for the ground state properties.
Yeah.
And I represent system states.
And then put beta equal to.
Beta goes to infinity, of course, yeah.
It's also possible to discuss a finite temperature in which
and then take a limit.
Finite dimension in terms of imaginary time.
And so basically the argument is that, well, if you have no structure between the water lines, like spaghetti-like, nothing will stop one of them just wind around the system. The moment you wind, it's immediately, it's the formula is exact. So there is a coefficient of proportionality, but the formula is exact. The moment one of the water lines goes around the system, it's a superfluid.
What is rho s? What is w?
Rho s is superfluid density. W is a winding number which counts how many times some of the water line has gone around the system. The moment you have a winding number, the superfluid density is finite.
Is this the same as the number of crossing continuous lines?
Sorry?
Is this W the same as the number of
crossings? No, no. Crossings have nothing to do with winding numbers. Winding numbers in topological sense.
Well, you forgot to mention periodic boundary conditions. And
just stop it. When I say wind around the system, you have periodic boundary conditions. So in topological sense, well, this trajectory, well, this is going from zero to beta. Beta goes later on to infinity. This is real space. I can draw in 1D only because, well, it's a black one. So this trajectory has no winding number. So this trajectory has a winding number.
Okay.
It goes around the cylinder and comes back. Why it's important? Because if you look at the response of the system to the gauge field, for example, you introduce a gauge inside the system, the trajectory which winds around the system will be sensitive to the gauge flux. Well, and basically, yeah.
You are going to put beta in the end infinity, correct?
Yeah.
So does it mean that W will go to infinity also or no?
You have to do both. You put beta to infinity and real space to infinity.
Mm-hmm.
So you take thermodynamic limit and zero temperature.
And W.
So if W is a finite number, it means superfluid density is finite. Because if it's any finite system, even a good crystal will give you for very, very long time with exponentially small probability but still finite, you'll get some winding numbers. It's simply the question whether it's exponentially rare process or it's a regular one. So if it's a spaghetti, suppose it's just a square box, and I will scale beta. Well, this is safe to say because, well, because the confined criticality is a theory where dynamical critical exponent is 1.
So W will be a union number per unit length,
or what? No, W is the winding number for the whole system.
And it is finite for infinite system?
Depends whether it's superfluid or a solid.
Yeah, so for superfluid, it will be finite for infinite system.
Well, let me write down the formula. Rho S equals mass, temperature, which is beta.
The number of rotation is remains finite for infinite system.
Yeah, I'm right.
Beta is in the denominator. Now I understand.
And also the system size is also in the denominator.
Well, that's it. Well, you have a coefficient of proportionality, yeah. So the question is, well, if this is exponential in the system size, beta doesn't matter. Of course, well, if you simply increase, your chances to make a winding number grow linearly is beta.
What is not trivial that it is not proportional to the length, but
the no, yeah, there is a length also. Nikola, why don't you divide by L?
There is no L in two dimensions.
So W squared is proportional to L.
Depends on dimensionality.
Just wait. W is an integer, period. Now, if it's a superfluid,
yeah,
it's a superfluid. W square in a two-dimensional superfluid, a 4D unity.
Uh-huh.
This is a superfluid. W square average is proportional to E minus some number system size in a solid. And this is superfluid. I'm in two dimensions. The whole discussion today is two dimensions, not three-dimensional solids, only two
dimensions. Rho S is 5.
Yep.
Beta goes to infinity.
Yep.
So W squared is proportional to L.
Oh, at very low temperature. Okay, it's proportional to beta, of course. Well, I'm writing finite size scaling. It's proportional to beta, of course.
This is also non-trivial, because I would expect that it is proportional to beta squared.
No,
L
squared or beta. Beta is definitely linear, because you simply give more chances, the system will start repeating itself. After you pass all the correlation lengths, the system will start repeating itself. You can make a winning number on the interval beta. Next time, you have equal chances to make another one, another one, another one. Mm-hmm. So W squared is proportional to beta.
So it's like diffusion. Yeah, it's like
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's standard diffusion because, well, that's what I'm saying. Well, there is no memory in imaginary time if it's sufficiently long.
Mm-hmm. Superfluidity defined by order and momentum space, but how do you
know? Well, it's response to the gauge flux, for example, if you like. Well, if you ask me, well, what's the definition of the superfluid density? It's the second derivative of free energy or energy at zero temperature over the gauge flux which you introduce into the system.
So the point goes back to Feynman, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Well, the formula itself was derived by separately because it's very useful. All you have to do is to count winding numbers, and you immediately get the superfluid density. Because the problem in numerical simulations is that, well, superfluid density cannot be written as local operator. It's a linear response coefficient for the whole system. So you cannot calculate it by any means which are related to, I know, kinetic potential energy or any of the local operators. You need some global, I know, geometrical properties of the system. And they are winding numbers. So numerically, it's very convenient because winding numbers are easy to watch. And they give you the superfluid density right away. But the argument was that if I have spaghetti-type word line, which means disordered word line structure, then it's a superfluid. So the state is superfluid, it's ordered. Well, if you introduce some order in the system, which means you break translation symmetry, and the system has some guidelines, dashed lines, for example, then the word lines are fluctuating around those guiding marks. They don't make winding numbers. Of course, well, when I say they don't make winding numbers, I assume this limit, and then you can take both to infinity. Or at least, well, keep beta as a sum power of L. Because in a solid, the exponent will just kill everything if it's a solid. So this would be a solid structure. You don't make winding numbers. Superfluid density scales to zero in a thermodynamic limit. Everything is fine. But then you have to break translation symmetry, which allows you to tell that some of the word lines are extra or missing. So if you make a structure and break translation symmetry, then yes, you can tell the dotted lines are not making the winding number. And looks like, well, that's all we have. Either you have a structure which breaks translation symmetry and tells you how to organize word lines, or you don't. In this case, you have a solid. In this case, you have a superfluid. You don't have the quantum disordered phase. I would say the argument is almost exact for the positive statistics of word lines, when I can discuss what is typical in terms of word line structure. There is one missing point here, is topological order. Because there are models, specially designed models, when locally you cannot tell there is any particular structure in the word lines. But there is a global constraint on their behavior. The typical model would be something like this. For example, if I write down a model and I say that whenever one boson, this is kind of reminiscent of the ring exchange term. Just imagine I don't have single particle hopping, none at all. And I only have this term. And see what this term says. This term says that, well, if I have a boson here and a boson here, the only dynamics is that I have them in this fashion, or backwards. Now you see that the number of bosons for any particular row and column is exactly conserved. Moreover, just, well, the current operator is exactly zero. For any boson moving in one direction, there is a boson moving in exactly the same direction at the same time.
But it cannot, on the second step, they can go to the
mass. Locally, it will look like a liquid.
Yeah.
But by the nature of the matrix element, I proved to you that the number of bosons for any row and any column is a conserved number. And I immediately see that the current operator is exactly zero. The current cannot flow because for any boson moving left, there is a boson moving right at the same time. On a large length scale, there is definitely nothing. You cannot conduct current. So k equals 0 count definitely 0. So it's definitely not superfluid. It can look like a liquid locally, but it's not a superfluid because of the well. But this is a particular class of Hamiltonian. So I would say just excluding topological orders. But it's also an order. It's not a quantum disordered phase when, I know, you can start Ginzburg-Landau expansion.
Let me ask you, it looks like you have here this very similar to this term, only B are connected, not nearest neighbors.
No, the hopping of this boson is a nearest neighbor hopping.
Could you write this one? Operators, what this year?
I already wrote them. Okay, I, J, K, L. So you have B, I, B, K deleted. You have B, J, Dega, B, L, Dega, K. And all the other terms in translation invariant way.
Yeah.
That's all.
So, yeah, that's understood. So why this term cannot give you the superfluidity as that?
Because without this one, this Hamiltonian has no current. By definition, what you make is just, well, for any boson going left, there is a boson moving right. This Hamiltonian doesn't support any current.
This is called Wedens bond? This is a Wedens bond, right, if you put T to theta.
Well, Wedens bond is a solid. No, Wedens bond solid is not discussed. It's a solid is solid, fine.
Yeah.
But in this Hamiltonian, you may have also a phase which has a topological order.
You call this phase topological order? Has topological order?
It's not a Wedens bond.
Is a spin liquid or my impression spin liquid has topological.
Again, well, you're asking for the name. Yeah. The name is irrelevant. It's a state which has no translational symmetry breaking. It's still translationally invariant.
Does not break any symmetry.
It doesn't break any symmetry. It's not superfluid, it's not solid, but it's not superfluid in the sense that, well, I cannot conduct current by construction. The Hamiltonian does not support current, period.
Some people call it a boson liquid or something.
No, it's not a liquid. It's a topologically ordered phase. It's topologically ordered because, well, you have infinite number of conservation laws in this system. You cannot change the number of bosons per column. You cannot change the number of bosons per row. You can call it a fluid if you like.
We cannot call it a fluid. We can call it a liquid, but it's not a fluid.
Yeah, whatever.
It cannot support a flow. So maybe the same thing as people call the boson liquid.
No, it's not a boson liquid. Yes, Boris said incorrectly. Well, it's a liquid which doesn't flow, if you like. This type of phases they call topologically ordered. They are right borderline between liquid and solid in a sense that, well, they cannot conduct current, but they don't break translational symmetry. But they are specially designed models. That's not the general Hamiltonian.
But you cannot see if it has a topological order or not.
There is no local probe which will tell you about the topological order. But globally, the system, well, Ashwin probably will say better.
There are generic Hamiltonians that get you into topologically ordered states. So I think this is a very sort of pathological.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not even sure it should be called topologically ordered. But for example, you know, Jongbach has studied this model on chamomile lattice.
No, I'm not saying, well, I just give an example. I'm not saying just, well, all the topologically ordered phases are from this Hamiltonian, no.
No,
I'm just trying to make sense. That, well, you see how it can happen. There is a claim. It's called exciton liquid by Fischer. And the claim is that even if you add this term and it's small, the model remains topologically ordered. So it looks like generic, but that's the claim. It was never verified numerically, but that's the theoretical claim. Even if you add this term being small, you do not destroy the topological order.
Okay, so I guess what you mean by topological order is that
I mean the following. It doesn't break translation symmetry. It looks liquid-like locally, but there are global conservation laws which do not allow you to have superfluidity.
If we switch off hopping, we can only say that the model is severely constrained.
Yeah. Well, then it's obvious. If I switch off hopping, all my claims are immediately obvious, what I am saying.
Right.
But the theoretical claim is that even if I add hopping, the model survives as a topologically ordered one.
Yeah,
So, you know, there are examples where you don't need to make this very pathological kind of construction, right, where you can have generic hopping, certain kinds of interactions, which get you into a phase that has no broken symmetry.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I was trying just, well, for people who never saw it, just to have a feeling that, well, that's how you can start. But then if I add this term, it becomes a generic Hamiltonian. There's nothing bad or good about this Hamiltonian. It's generic Hamiltonian. The claim is it may have a topological order.
So, you know, in a previous slide, you say that that phase doesn't exist, right?
No. I was saying that quantum disordered phase doesn't exist. Topologically ordered phase is not disordered. It's ordered in a way.
Okay, so that's what you're saying. That
yeah, that's my definition, of course. This is my definition.
So topologically ordered, half the ring, that's got to be topologically ordered.
Yeah, it has to be topologically ordered. That's right. So I'm saying the only possibilities are liquid, superfluid, solid, or topologically ordered. Not completely quantum disordered, as Ginzburg-Landau would suggest. There's no orders whatsoever, you don't care about anything.
Let me understand that argument again. So you're saying in this world-line picture, you cannot imagine a world-line configuration which would correspond to the quantum.
I'm trying to say that, well, if there is no topological order, it's a case which we already discussed. If you have spaghettis, it's a superfluid. Yeah. To avoid spaghettis, you structure the space. You're in a solid. So you have no place to have quantum, fully quantum disordered phase. Just doesn't show up. If it's fully disordered, it's spaghetti-like, it's a superfluid. So that's the argument.
What does S mean? SF and S solid?
It's a superfluid, this is solid, yeah.
Solid, S is solid, okay.
Yeah.
I guess maybe another way of phrasing that question is, if I think of a topologically ordered phase, how do I think of it in terms of world lines?
That... Yeah.
No, I'm trying to understand.
You can.
No, you can't imagine.
Of course. You don't see it locally, but globally, of course, you see.
That's a topological order phase.
Yeah, but probably my question is why there has to be a topological order.
Okay, so that's related to the fact, what do you think about a topologically ordered phase in the world line picture?
So,
Z2 topologically ordered, let's say, what does it look like in the world line picture?
So in that case, basically, for example, if you have a G2 spherical on a torus, then basically there are four different sectors.
Yeah.
Right. So basically, you don't go from one configuration to the other configuration.
But I think those sectors are not in terms of world lines.
So it's a slightly different picture.
Is there a good picture to think of it in terms of world lines?
That's what I was asking.
There is a picture. Is that good picture? If you think of everything is polarized, and then the different sectors is like, you know, winding one loop around the torus, and that one loop would actually correspond to exactly one road line going around the system.
And
that is always existing.
Right.
Yeah. So it's basically you're ending up with an odd number of road lines all the time, or an even number of road lines. So really the loop that you spin around the torus is something which exists as one road line.
But this is a time.
So
the goal of the discussion was that superfluid and solid orders are not that independent, as Ginzburg-Landau naive.
Enjoy one, you have to create the other.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the driving force to basically to develop either new theory or to modify Ginzburg-Landau.
In terms of vortices, this is also obvious that, you know, when you think of destroying superfluidity by proliferating vortices, when you proliferate vortices, there's a dual theory in which
Go to the normal gas.
Well, okay, at zero temperature.
That's the problem. Exactly, you're right. Well, if at zero temperature you proliferate vortices, what do you have? Solid.
Right.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Now, how to describe it at the phenomenological level? You say, okay, we have, I'll present Ginzburg-Landau. I would say, well, you don't have to be so naive in doing Ginzburg-Landau. You say, okay, yes, I have my order parameters. The first two, well, it's kind of multi-component order parameter. Can I ask you to stop body? It's impossible. Just stop. So you start from the multi-dimensional order parameter, and you say, well, the first two components are superfluid order. It's a complex number, so I'll write down two. Then you have, say, checkerboard. Then you have valence bond. Maybe Plaquette solid and so on. So I would say just because, well, we don't have the luxury of having quantum disordered phase, we'll simply demand in this Ginzburg-Landau that this multi-component order parameter always has finite modules. Just forbidden to have it zero. And once you say it, you immediately see that, well, you exclude the first part here, and you are left only with the first order phase transition or coexistence. So you have to have super solid phase in between, or it has to be a first order phase transition. Probably I don't have to discuss this, it's probably obvious. Okay. So once you say, well, Ginzburg-Landau has a fixed modulus.
That's both go to zero at one point.
Yeah. But basically, well, you see, well, to have this order vanishing continuously at some point where this one starts.
Why first order?
Why first order?
Yeah.
Because they, okay, then I have to go through the argument. Okay, so basically it says the following. If you have multidimensional sphere, because, well, this is kind of multidimensional vector parameter, it has some surface in a multidimensional space. Now, there is an energy landscape. You have order in one direction or you have order in another direction. Mm-hmm. This multidimensional landscape can have two properties. Either you have very high symmetry and you can rotate without any barriers from one point to another point. It's large angle rotation. Then it's just higher symmetry point and the energy landscape is absolutely flat. It's a special case, requires fine tuning. Otherwise, as you rotate along the sphere, either you have a minimum in energy, which means you already have coexistence, or you have a maximum, which means that the two points are separated by barrier.
Another reduced symmetry, for example,
that's a
three-dimensional rotation, you have two-dimensional.
Yeah, but along the path, you make a large angle motion. Along this path, energy is either constant, or it has a barrier, which means first order, or it has a minimum, which means you already have a coexistence before. So you either have coexistence, or you have a barrier, which means first order. That's all. Just because in this picture, the surface cannot shrink to zero. I require that modulus is always non-zero. And because, well, my multidimensional surface never shrinks to zero, I cannot transform one order parameter into another one without making large angle rotation. And if it's not a special symmetry, which is definitely, well, it's fine tuning. If I don't have any special fine tuning, the energy landscape, as I make a large angle rotation, always has a minimum or a maximum. So it's either coexistence or first order. So it's unescapable because I have to make large angle motion on a surface. If I can shrink the surface to zero, yes, I can transform one order parameter into another one continuously. But if it's always finite modulus, Ginzburg-Landau says it's always first order coexistence. So that's the minimal modification which you need to say, okay, well, this will repair the problem. So that's why liquid solid transitions are always first order. Or you go through the super solid phase. So that's how it should be. Well, there is an alternative. I'll just skip this part. There is an alternative scenario which was developed in those papers. It's a long list of authors contributing, which says, well, apart from Ginzburg-Landau, probably there is also a generic scenario which is not part of this Ginzburg-Landau paradigm with the constant modulus of the multi-component order parameter. Again, well, this is order parameter. So, and there is a point in the parameter space, and maybe that's a whole region in the parameter space, when superfluid and solid order simply change places. Of course, the motivation came from the previous discussion that, well, superfluidity, when it vanishes, it has to create a solid. And that's kind of the nature of the system. So why not thinking that, well, the two are dual and somehow related to each other, so whenever one is vanishing, the other emerges. And you try to develop a theory, well, how this can happen. You can do it purely theoretically, or you can actually, well, have a reasonably good picture of how this type of transitions can happen. And this was, I don't know exactly who developed it, but somebody told me, well, Saintil was the first one just while showing the pictures of, at the microscopic level, how this can happen. So you start thinking, how a solid order can be destroyed? Well, if it's checkerboard, it's Ising type system, you say, well, okay, well, you create domains of another solid order. Now, if you have a solid which has fourfold symmetry, you can create two domain walls and look at the intersection of two domain walls. So this is the structure of the valence bond solid, and you ask for the softest mode, how you can destroy the valence bond solid. Because before solid is destroyed, it becomes superfluid, you have some defects proliferating. So what are they? And you see that, well, in this case, you say, well, this defect will cost me a lot of energy because you have domain wall here, you have domain wall here, domain wall here, and domain wall here. So usually domain walls cost you energy. But the argument is that, well, in this type of models, they are very much the same as the so-called four-clock model. So it's conventional XY model. Cosine theta I minus theta j and you add here a term cosine, say, 4 theta I. And this term simply tries to pin the face. Well, without this term, you would like to have XY order, which means you would like your face to be locked, but well, the direction of the face is arbitrary. It's
so
U1C. Yeah. But this term simply says, okay, no, you have to select one of the four angles because four directions for these angles have the lowest energy. Mm-hmm. Well, probably I have to put here minus, it doesn't matter. And this is known as four-clock model. And then you say, well, okay, that's roughly how you can describe the valence bond solid. Maybe if I can ignore this term, which actually tries to select the direction for one of the solid orders, this would be just some new U1 symmetry. When I'm sitting here, it's the intersection of the main walls, which also exist in this model. Because, well, if I have this clock, the face can tunnel from, not tunnel, transform from one angle to another angle, but I'll have to pay the main wall energy. But it's well known that, well, as this model gets to the critical point of the pure XY model, this term gets irrelevant. Which means if I start destroying valence bond solid by those defects, the first thing which happens is that the main wall energy goes to zero. So it becomes irrelevant whether I have this main wall energy, forget about it. And in the middle, the intersection behaves like a vortex. So basically the valence bond solid is rotating its order around the central point. And the central point is missing one atom, because remember the vacuum is half filled. So it's half filling everywhere. So I subtract half filling. This side is missing the particle. Of course, I can have an extra particle here. So this is called the spin-on. So if you count from vacuum, if there is no occupation number is zero on this side, but you count from vacuum, it's a charge minus 1/2.
The linear energy of the main walls.
The linear energy dies away. It's the RG argument for the four-clock model, that if you approach to the critical point of this model, the domain wall energy becomes irrelevant. You can ignore. So that's the argument. It's as I destroy valence bond solid, domain wall energy is the first thing which becomes irrelevant. You don't care about domain wall energy. So that's the argument presented here. And basically you say, well, okay, well, then you can write down the whole theory of how valence bond solid superfluid transition happens in terms of those spin-ons. They will behave like vortices, but you have two types of them because, well, this can be charge minus 1/2 or charge plus 1/2, depending whether you have a particle here or not. So you have two species of vortices which couple by logarithmic interactions. Well, if it's, one point, they couple just like vortices in a neutral superfluid by the gauge field. So that's the theory of deconfined criticality. That's not my part. Ashwin can just present it better. So that's kind of that's how you can come from the microscopic analysis to say that, well, if this point doesn't happen as a continuous phase transition, you need a continuous phase transition for the same argument. It has to be a continuous phase transition to have a legitimate argument that the clock is not working. So the clock doesn't work only if the transition is continuous. So assuming a continuous...
The fourfold breaking symmetry.
Well, if this is two or three, it's first order phase transition.
By the way, if it's three, it's well established.
It's first order. Yeah, it's well established. If it's three clock model, it's first order.
Oh,
at least
three.
Yeah, three states. This is two coupled eyes in one.
Yeah. Four clock says, well, this term is irrelevant. You don't change the universality class of the transition. Yeah. But that's an important argument. You need continuous point to make sure that this term is irrelevant, so you can drop it.
So the critical value is something between the three and the
I know only three and four. What is in between, I don't know, because this has to be a 2 pi periodic.
So four is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Three is relevant.
Three is relevant, and you have first order.
Four is relevant.
Four is irrelevant. It's marginally relevant.
So that means that if you would consider the same model on triangular lattice, the property would be absolutely different.
Yeah, could be. So this is about square lattice.
But by the way,
conical lattice.
Conical lattice.
It's not directly relevant to this discussion, but I will just correct one misconception. You keep talking about like when super fluid dies in a generic model, then solenoid should show up, but that is actually not true, right?
With the exception of topological orders.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no, you don't need an extra conservation law to show
up. I never said it.
Okay, I mean you don't need the extra conservation like this to.
Yeah, I never said it.
You know, you could have a super fluid to some fractionalized bag.
Yeah. Yeah, but I never said I need the conservation law. <Yeah.
laughs> If you talk about the bipartialities, no frustration, that's strictly right.
No, he's trying to say that if topologically ordered faces do not require some conservation laws which are right obvious from the Hamiltonian, they can be an emergent phenomenon as well.
Doesn't require
extra
consideration.
But you need frustration.
Yeah.
You always need frustrated.
No. This type of model.
There's no frustration.
That's this type of model. It has no frustration.
I know.
The claim is that theoretically this model has a topological order.
To some extent depends on what you mean by frustration.
Yeah.
But there are models without sign problems that are in Z2 topological phases, for example.
Yeah. But we are not discussing topologically ordered spaces.
Sure.
Do you remember what is Z1 and Z2? That's the two.
Oh, yeah, I just didn't come to this. So basically, you write down the transition in terms of spin on field. So this is a spin on field.
Right.
You can call it Z. You have two species of them because, well, it can be charge 1/2 or minus 1/2.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you have two species of complex numbers, Z. Well, sometimes I call them psi. This is just a complex number, nothing else. So this is classical action. It's D plus 1 already. So you have two species. They couple to each other through the gauge field because they are vortices in the U1 liquid. Well, the rest is just standard Ginzburg-Mandel. And basically, well, this is exactly what the whole transformation means. You can do it formally without even referring to the microscopic picture, how you destroyed valence bond solid. For this, you simply, it's a well-established mathematical trick to have a duality between particle ward lines in the normal state and vortices in the superfluid. This is already a result which is almost 30 years old. How in 2 plus 1, you make an exact transformation between particle ward lines and properties of vortices in a three-dimensional neutral superfluid. It's 1-to-1. And so when you do this mapping, half filling is reflected in the fact that you have magnetic flux per plaquette, which is 1/2. So you write down the tight binding spectrum with the magnetic flux 1/2. You find two minima in the Brillouin zone, and you make low energy expansion around the minima. So you end up naturally with two species of fields. In this, after duality, they are vortices. They are coupled through the gauge field, and that's how you derive exactly the same action. This is absolutely formal. You simply do the duality between particle and vortices, and you arrive at the picture where you do, strictly speaking, now you start doing Ginzburg-Landau. You say Ginzburg-Landau in conventional way is impossible because you don't have the quantum disordered phase to start the expansion. But superfluid, after this duality, superfluid is exactly the playing ground to start Ginzburg-Landau. But your prime fields have to be, all order parameters which you are trying to write, everything has to be written in terms of vortex field. And superfluid is exactly the disordered phase for vortices. And then you simply write down everything as a Ginzburg conventional Ginzburg-Landau in terms of vortex fields. The only price you pay is that, well, your Ginzburg-Landau is long-range. That's all. So this is conventional Ginzburg-Landau. Forget about A. This is, would be standard Ginzburg-Landau expansion. What happens here, just because they are vortices, you simply have gauge coupling. Well, you can integrate gauge because it's non-compact. It's from minus to plus infinity, and the action is Gaussian. You can always integrate the gauge field, and this will induce long-range interactions between the Z.
Is this a description of phases or not?
It's only for the critical point.
So, I mean, when you do this procedure, you end up getting...
Because this is thrown away. This is thrown away.
When you derive this model, you get it for some... You know, you derive some parameters for this model.
Yeah.
So, you know, conceivably, that model itself might have more than one phase.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's exactly the topic.
So you need a duality language. Z stands for the two kinds of vortices.
Yeah.
Okay. So if Z condenses, the vortices condense, you get the solid effect.
Valence
bond,
yeah,
if Z...
No, it's opposite. So in this case, these are vortices in the valence bond solid. So if vortices are absent, that's valence bond solid. When vortices proliferate, it's a superfluid. It's already after duality. So you have to switch your mind backwards.
But what I'm saying is the model has more than one
phase.
Phase, then there are more than one scenario.
More than two. We're definitely trying to describe a transition between valence bond solid and superfluid, but there is also a possibility of supersolid as well. So definitely on the screen, we should think about three phases right away.
No, I'm not talking about phases. If you only consider two phases, I'm not talking about additional phases. I'm only considering two phases, and the model describes a critical point.
Yeah,
if two possible phases, then it means there's two critical behaviors for the two possible transitions between those two phases. Because the model, it could have two critical points, or it has one critical point, or?
Or the whole line? Well, I have lots of parameters. You can draw a line or plane. The question is whether this action is describing a transition between valence bond solid and superfluid, this one, at the continuous transition. The action is written under the assumption that this point does exist. That's the action for this point. That's the appropriate long wavelength theory for this point.
So what is the physical meaning of this Z?
It's a complex number. Complex number.
It's mathematical. What do they describe?
They describe vortex fields. Just like conventional psi, which we write down here. I say, well, if I replace this by psi I star psi j, where psi is a complex number, this will be the classical analog of the superfluid transition in the bosonic system. But I can write down immediately the classical model, which has the same properties.
So your vortices are kind of bosons?
They are just like particles. In D plus one, when I was writing the word lines, we were saying, okay, this is the particle trajectory in imaginary time. But think that, well, this is actually a vortex line in a neutral superfluid. They have exactly the same configuration space. So when I was saying here, well, you write down the path integral representation for particles in imaginary time, this has to one-to-one correspondence with properties of vortices in a three-dimensional superfluid.
So when they appear, when Z is not zero, superfluidity is destroyed?
No, you look for orders in Z's, where the phase is locked or phase is not locked. Just like in the conventional Psi 4 model, you look for the order parameter. Whether the phases of complex numbers look in the same direction as superfluid, or it's disordered, it's a normal phase. So it's same here. Well, those are complex numbers. You look for orders between the complex numbers. Basically, the model is describing two charged superfluids. So each superfluid is described by the complex field psi 4, but they are charged. And because they are charged, they couple through the gauge. Well, that's how I simply describe the coupling between them. It's exactly the same.
As far as I understand, Z, to say model Z square, is a density of vortices, correct?
Yeah.
And if it is not zero, if Z is not zero, average Z, then is the superfluidity destroyed or not?
Well, this is local. This is Zi. It's a local property. It doesn't tell you anything.
If your phase is such that Z average is not zero, there is no red joint.
That's right.
In Z.
Yeah, you can look for Z average, zero or non-zero.
Zero. So if it is not zero, the superfluidity is destroyed or not?
Finite Za.
Yeah.
It's a superfluid. In terms of prime bosonic particles.
But that is density of vortices. Not
density of vortices in the bond solid order parameter, in the valence bond solid order parameter. It's not vortices in the superfluid order parameter.
They're not vortices in the true superfluid. It's after the mapping. I'm simply saying it's an analogy. They are vortices in the valence bond solid.
Or like dislocations, it's like deformation.
When vortices in the valence bond solid proliferate, valence bond solid is destroyed. It becomes superfluid. Mm-hmm. So So in this picture, well, there are vortices in the valence bond solid.
So in a way, z squared is the density of superfluid.
Z squared. No.
That's not topological.
This term is just irrelevant. It gives you how big is the.
That's the cartoon.
If z is zero, there is no.
If z on average is zero, it's a valence bond solid.
There is no superfluid. If z is not zero,
it's a superfluid.
Is z proportional to the density of superfluid?
Again, this action is written for the critical.
Is it yes or no?
The answer is irrelevant. I'm trying to answer. Again, this is the action.
But on the other hand, if it is zero, there is no superfluid.
Again,
if it is not zero,
formally as written.
There should be some.
Formally as written in those terms. Forget it. I will just stop making the transformation from bosonic language to Z language. Okay? So in terms of the Z language, entirely Z, when Z is not zero, vortices proliferate.
Okay.
In this language, I promised you not to say anything about the bosonic language. So this means order in the Z field. So it's a superfluid in the Z field. Mm-hmm. Ask any other question. It's superfluid, yes, it has finite superfluid density.
These are two different cases. Z1 not zero, Z2 is zero, and Z2 is zero, Z not zero, Z1 is zero.
It's not possible because it's
different superfluids.
Again, irrelevant because in this action it's absolutely symmetric. No, it's symmetric. Z1, and it's an important part of the confined criticality that vortices 1 and vortices 2, they're identically the same. It's symmetric action. It's not possible to have one, not the other. But it's possible to have the following. You may have ZA, ZB, non-zero. It's possible.
It's possible, for example, that you have.
But this is zero. ZA average is zero. ZB average is also zero. But the product of the two can be non-zero. That's fine. Because vortices can pair, and you can proliferate in the paired channel. That's allowed. Well, just forget about those spin-ons and valence bond solid. Look at this as if I have two charged superfluids. Two charged superfluids. So I have electrons and positrons. They couple to each other by the same gauge field. So they are charged particles. I'm looking for the normal superfluid transition because, well, this is already action. So think about three-dimensional finite temperature transition in a system of electrons and positrons, how they go from normal state to a superfluid state. And this is an exact analogy what we are talking here. Well, just to make some sense what this action means. So Z1, it's electron. Z2, it's positron. And I'm looking for the transition temperature. Tc from the normal state to the superconducting state. And I would like to know the universality class of this transition, whether it can happen as first order or it has to happen as a second order. So that's the exact analogy for this action. It's a charged two-component system which wants to go from normal to superfluid state, but I have exact symmetry between the fields. If it happens, it happens at once with both of them.
I guess you have to assumption that electrons and positrons are of the same charge, and then they are bosons.
They are. Oh, yeah, sorry. so the transition happens not by pairing. Bosons, right. Yeah. They have to condense in a single particle sense, not in terms of pairing.
The
charge is the same also.
Yes. Yeah.
So they are not
of the same sign.
Charge is different.
Same.
Charge
same.
Is different.
Because the charge of a spin-on is 1/2. So.
No, the charge of a spin-on is plus 1/2 or minus 1/2.
Right, but when you have a superfluid, it's not neutral, right? It's not counterflow superfluid. It's just right? Same charge.
No, if you want to look at this action in terms of some physical analogy.
Basically, two superconductors also will work, right? Two species superconductors.
With preformed Cooper pairs, yeah, something like that.
Okay, well, we started with quite different system. This is a kind of representation.
Yeah.
So returning to this initial system.
There is no way out. That's the only thing which is left to discuss. The first one was Ginzburg-Landau with fixed modulus, and we are done, first order. With the Ginzburg-Landau picture, when you just don't calculate anything but claim finite modulus, you say it's first order. You cannot go from liquid to a solid in a continuous way. It has to be first order. This is an alternative theory, and that's the only way you can go in alternative theory to understand what the properties of this action are. So we are bound to study this action, nothing else.
We also should define what should be measured to find it. And this is a question. What experimental facts is described here?
The order of the transition between liquid and solid. I'm looking for the ground state transition between liquid and solid, and I would like to know whether it's first order or second order.
Superfluid and solid.
Yeah.
Superfluid and solid. Now, the question is that what I can measure in superfluid is superfluid things.
For example, yeah.
That is the problem most.
You can measure this plot easily.
Or condensate density.
You measure the structure factor. You measure the structure factor. You measure superfluid density or condensate density at zero temperature. And this is what Ginzburg-Landau says, you'll see.
So my question is, what is the connection between rho s and z?
Again, well, you're asking about experimental terms.
No connection.
None. Because this is the action for the critical point only. This action does not describe any of the phases. This is action only for this point. You can find spin-ons as vertices, and the whole action is written for the red point only. It has nothing to do with the phase to the left or phase to the right.
Okay. So that is simple fluctuation of Hamiltonian in this point. Okay. Now, then the question is, I can probably calculate such a thing as, density fluctuation, which shows me how should I do that through this part?
At the critical point.
In this point.
This is all written in the papers of those sources. I say it's irrelevant. Let me finish. It's irrelevant for the following reason. I will argue that this point doesn't exist. So why bothering calculating properties of this action for some physical observable? So that's my perspective. I say before you calculate properties of the continuous phase transition, I know how you observe it in some properties, what system does at the critical point, let's first verify that this point does exist.
Why don't we move on?
Okay. Yeah. I'm answering the questions.
Okay. No, that's fine.
Yeah, so far I'm nowhere because I just presented the stage.
In this point, probably superfluid density is zero, right? Though we know that in two dimensions, superfluid density in critical point is not zero, correct?
No, it's a three-dimensional system. It's zero temperature.
But it's three-dimensional.
It's a macrophase transition. So,
yeah. It's zero. So in this meaning, we should not consider anything. But we can consider, for example, the critical correlations, like density-density correlations.
Absolutely, we can consider critical correlations as well.
Connection to the correlation to say z?
Yeah, I have a very good answer.
Can you move on? There is still like 1 hour and 15.
Yeah, but I cannot stop you asking questions. It's an agreement between you. Because if the question is asked, I have to answer, right?
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
I'm saying yes. It's possible to use this action. I'll finish. The question was asked. If you use this action, you can calculate properties, assuming it's a continuous phase transition. But my job is to prove there is none. As long as there is no continuous phase transition here, this action doesn't work. Use something else. That's why it's too early yet to study properties of this action at the critical point, before you verify the point does exist. I'll probably skip a couple of slides. I'm just trying to say that, you can write, this is written in terms of not z's, but psi's, it's exactly the same. They are complex numbers. There are different ways you can present exactly the same. It can be field theory, Maybe you like this one more. You can write it down as XY model. It has a smaller number of parameters. It has only parameter J and K. So this is just one field, which is represented by Psi 4, another field represented by Psi 4, and they are coupled by the gauge. That's another model which has same properties in the long wavelength limit. Or you can write down another action. They are so-called J currents in a three-dimensional. This is action, this is action, this is action. So this action says, well, you have integer currents. Maybe, well, not everybody is familiar with this representation. I'll do a two-dimensional plot, but it's three-dimensional. J currents, they are simply integers living on bonds of a lattice, and they have to obey the constraint of being closed loops. So that's the model. It's a statistical model of a loop gas where loops, currents, are coupled to each other by long-range forces, and this is given, the inverse Fourier transform of this coupling is given by inverse sinusine squared. So it's Coulomb-type coupling at large distances. So for r minus r prime much bigger than 1, then the lattice constant, q r minus r prime, is a Coulomb force. So that's the coupling. And that's exactly how vortices couple in helium. So if you want to write down the energy functional of a particular vortex tangle in helium, you'll write down this energy functional, where J is a current along the vortex. Well, it's kind of a vector pointing along the vortex. It's up or down depending on the vorticity, whether it's clockwise or anticlockwise.
All J commute? All J commute?
They're classical numbers. They're integers. They're integers. It's action. They are integers.
That is
the final representation. Yeah, the integer on a bond. I'll make only one picture just to make sure that, well, it's easy to understand what's done here. That's how you basically arrive to the J current model. Imagine I have, that's a cartoon example explaining, but you can make the whole argument exact for the entire discussion previously. Suppose I start from checkerboard solid. This is my vacuum. You look at the fluctuation on top of the checkerboard vacuum. The simplest possible fluctuation. Particle hops on nearest neighbor side, stays on this side for a while, and comes back. Now, if I subtract vacuum, so I simply characterize all fluctuations as a current configuration where vacuum is subtracted. That's kind of a typical exercise. Then you end up with a loop. So this is kind of the representation of fluctuations on top of a particular vacuum. You can do it in path integral representation. Formally, you can go through the same exercise and arrive at the same model by other means. This is just one of the ways. Just to believe me that, well, when you talk about interacting particles, like a half-integer filling factor with bosons, ultimately you can derive everything as if it's a loop gas of closed loops. Closed loops is the constraint of particle number conservation. I simply call current going in the opposite direction if it's a hole with respect to a particular vacuum. So the rest was exactly as it was, but this is a hole. So this is a hopping event, this is a hopping event, this is occupation number, and this is occupation number minus counting from a particular vacuum. So it's one-to-one correspondence. And basically, well, that's the model which we did study. It has all the same long-range properties as this one, simply has a small number of parameters. It does have a transition between valence bond solid and superfluid, and we simply try to understand what type of transition it is. Yeah, okay, I will skip the derivation. It's a high-temperature series expansion. So I go to the phase diagram. What is the phase diagram of this section? For comparison, you can also look at the phase diagram when you replace long-range interaction, which is the subject of the confined criticality, with some short-range interaction, which will be standard normal superfluid transition into neutral liquids. So when I have long-range interactions, I talk about electrons and positrons, which are charged, still bosons. If I replace it with short-range interactions, just the subject of two neutral but symmetric liquids. And you see that the two phase diagrams are pretty close to each other. Well, actually, this model was derived in a different context of bosons and optical lattices, so just, well, don't pay too much attention. Apart from one thing, I'll just mention it. So the phase diagram does involve a lot of phase transitions. So from valence bond solid, you may have a direct transition to a superfluid state according to this action, and there is a phase transition line. But there is also a phase which is called superfluid solid, and it corresponds to order in this channel. It's because, well, remember, before this term is irrelevant, spin-ons are confined because, well, the main walls do cost you energy. So if I have a spin-on with one vorticity and another spin-on with the same kind of charge, say charge one-half, charge one-half, with the opposite vorticity, they attract each other. It definitely makes sense if vortices repel each other, just, well, with opposite vorticity, just to put them on the same spot, cancel all the currents around, and just have one particle. So vortices can pair. So if the charge, the long-range coupling, there is a charge. It's a dimensionless charge in front of the potential. So if this charge is sufficiently strong, spin-ons actually pair and form a particle. And then those particles proliferate. So when particles proliferate in the valence bond solid, you go to the superfluid solid. So the valence bond order across this line is not destroyed, but you get superfluidity in terms of particles. You simply close the vacancy interstitial gap for the valence bond solid. But the solid order remains. And you have it for sufficiently strong coupling between the spin-on fields. So it's definitely part of the phase diagram. Well, there is also, of course, a line when you have a superfluid solid, and you go to superfluid by destroying the solid order. This would be the standard part of the Ginzburg-Landau coexistence. It's also part of the deconfined critical action.
Can you just remind me, this has the anisotropy term?
Yeah, this is U1 cross U1.
Okay, with the
anisotropy,
it's not
xenon. Yeah. It's further. It's not here. Well, okay, it's too far.
That's relevant, right?
So I simply keep those two coefficients completely unrelated.
So you don't have the anisotropy cosine 14 in this.
And that's relevant.
No, which one?
This one.
The one that gives you
this one? No, this one is dropped out. Okay. You study the confined critical action as is.
Okay, that's what I was
saying. But I don't yeah. say, I mean, I imagine that term is relevant
in
the
phase.
No, it's relevant in the phase. Once you enter the...
It's real. When you go into a super solid, you're saying even a transition from a valence bond to super solid, at the critical point, this term is relevant or not?
Of course.
No, at the critical point, isn't it relevant?
No, it's irrelevant for criticality. It's relevant for identifying that valence bond order.
I thought it's just irrelevant at the critical point for going to a superfluid state, but you're saying it's also irrelevant by.
It doesn't change even. No, across this transition. At this transition.
Yeah, I'm talking about critical point. Yeah, so I understand that it's irrelevant at the on the red line, but I thought it would be relevant.
No, just wait. Red line is first order, so.
Okay,
I'm saying, well, across this line, this term simply doesn't change. It was valence bond, it remains valence bond. This term is fully operational. It's the largest term in the Hamiltonian on large scale.
Even on the blue line.
Yeah, it tells you that valence bond order is still there. But it becomes superfluid because particle hole excitations start proliferating.
Yeah, so
it's a supersolid.
Analyze
you do not identify
that line in the absence of that term.
Again, I identify phases once this term is there. But I'm talking right now about phase diagram of action as written. Let me repeat the goal. The deconfined critical action is written. It's the action of the critical point here only. But now I study the statistical mechanical problem of a particular action. That's the phase diagram of this action.
Fine, but what I would say is the critical, if you went and try to study the critical property, that's not your goal, right?
No,
I said your goal
no,
is the red line.
No.
But if you went and using that action, study the critical properties of the blue line, at the blue line,
it's a molecular superfluid.
You get a wrong answer.
It's a molecular superfluid.
No.
Yes, this term is, I simply.
That term is not just the phase.
No,
you're in the blue region. It's not just telling you about the phases. It's also changing the critical properties.
No. The critical properties here is U1. You break U1 symmetry, and the Fock log term is completely irrelevant for this. Because the solid order is preserved. Theta is looking in one direction. It's not fluctuating even.
You are talking about the different things.
Yeah.
You and me are talking about
it's order in this channel. Imagine you have a solid. When in the solid you have translational symmetry breaking. In our case, it says, okay, well, I have one of the four ground states, valence bond ground states. I'm not going to change this, but I'm going to dope this valence bond solid with particles and holes. So it has a superfluid component on top of the charge density wave. It's U1 transition.
I don't know why you call that superfluid. This is a vortex pair condensation.
Yeah.
So the symmetry.
It's exactly the same statement.
U1 symmetry was break down Z2.
Again, let me translate in terms of action as written. This one is a normal phase. In terms of action, this is a normal phase. This is a normal phase.
Yeah.
Where spinons form only small size loops. Because in terms of J currents, what I call valence bond solid.
So in your action, actually, you don't really have a BBS order parameter, right? Because you don't have.
Of course not. No, no. The action is no.
Just
translation. So valence bond solid is a phase where J currents form small loops. They do not proliferate. So basically, if I go far away in this direction,
the Z expectation value is to zero.
Here, the expectation value of Z is zero.
So in that phase, Z also equal to zero. In this phase, but Z not equal to zero.
Just let me finish with valence bond solid. I'll go to other phases. Superfluid solid. ZA is zero. ZA, ZB. Is non-zero. Field pair. So it's a molecular superfluid in terms of Z field. Okay, what I have here. These type of loops proliferate and get very big. So let me draw them. Individual loops are still small. But these type of loops get big. So it's a proliferation in this channel, but not in terms of individual loops.
So can you describe in this terms of the snooker's picture the phases by some fugacity? So what's the fugacity of snooker's?
I probably will. I already just give the whole description.
Well, that is only part of it. You're telling me what is proliferating, but you're not telling me what the fugacity is.
What do you mean by fugacity? I can calculate you any physical observable in terms of those loops. For example, if you ask for winding numbers of those loops, of course, well, that's exactly what we calculate. Winding numbers in different channels. Any observable can be calculated, but that's a relevant picture.
Well, I'm probably asking an irrelevant question, but I'm still interested in that.
Qualitative property is whether loops proliferate or not. And
of course, yeah.
The fugacity, you can change.
It's irrelevant. You can measure fugacity if you like inside the phase, but the action is no good for the phase. The action is good for a critical point. So
superfluid density in this phase is still equal to zero. Is that right?
Superfluid density in the molecular channel is non-zero.
Because Z equal to zero. So,
who cares about Z? In the molecular channel, it's non-zero. Superfluid density in molecular channel is non-zero. That's non-zero order parameter. Yeah. Order parameter in each field separately is zero. You take hydrogen, the nucleus order parameter is zero. But the helium order parameter is non-zero. But helium is a nucleus plus two electrons. It's a composite order parameter.
Yeah.
Pair condensate.
So the U1 symmetry was broken down V2 in this phase.
There was no U1 symmetry.
From here to here, you break U1.
So it's just a U1 transition.
From here to here, you break U1.
Mod Z2, if you wish. Mm-hmm. Which is still the same.
And finally, we have superfluid. And superfluid has both ZAs non-zero. It has to happen with both of them because the model is symmetric. There is no difference between 1 and 2. Okay.
Break U1, but not completely. Break U1.
Yeah.
Down to V2, but it's still the same. Locally, it looks the same.
So I have large loops for A equal 1 and for A equal 2. Both of them I have large loops.
In opposite directions. They go in one and the same direction.
Well, it's accidental, maybe. No, this goes here, this goes
there
here.
There are molecules. They have to go in one and the same direction. Because they're
molecules. Ah, okay. Right. Yeah.
So this first of the boundaries, they establish by looking at the jump in the winding number, or is that the way, is that how you establish the first of the boundary?
Okay, let's go to the subject of today's talk. Because so far we just mentioned the action as it is, and we would like to understand what this action does for only this transition. Yes. Right? We don't care about those lines. Yes, we can establish them, we know the universality class, but we are interested in what happens here. So, well, what is the technique? From the loop language, you see that while I'm hunting for the transition from this phase where all loops are small, in both colors, when I have all loops big in both colors. So I'm looking for this transition. You can determine the transition point by first. If loops are very small, you cannot make a winding number. So in this phase, winding numbers of both colors, or for the sum or for the difference, doesn't matter, all winding numbers here are zero. They're exponentially small. So it's, in terms of loops, it's a dead phase. This one has winding numbers which start growing. Well, if I simply scale L beta as L, you see that to have finite superfluid density, winding numbers actually scale as system size L. And I'm verifying the prediction of the confined criticality. The whole action is written in space-time symmetric fashion. There is no difference between space and time. So beta and L scale the same way. So the system is a cube. So I see that, well, in the superfluid phase, winding numbers scale with the system size as L. Now, finally, they go to infinity. So I'm looking for the transition where winding numbers in a thermodynamic limits jump from 0 to infinity. On one side of the transition, 0. On another side of the transition, it's infinity. So you can say, OK, well, the definition of the transition point will be, unfortunately, I changed the notation from W to M. M is the winding number. So you determine the transition point from the following condition. Winding numbers have to be of order unity. But also, if it's a scale invariant continuous transition, the whole distribution function of winding numbers is a universal function. Because winding numbers are the longest scale geometrical property of those loops. So the distribution is universal. And winding number square average is of order unity at the transition point. A little bit to one side, it's 0. A little bit to another side, it's infinity. So it's a good enough definition of the transition point, exactly in thermodynamic limit, when winding numbers are for the unit. So that's what I have in a superfluid. That's what I have in a solid. Well, this is what I have in the first order phase transition. My distribution becomes bimodal. Part of the sample, or part of the statistical time, if I am exactly at the first order phase transition, the system is behaving as an insulator. So it's very high statistics to have zero winding numbers. Or it can behave like a superfluid when you have a very, very, very shallow on this plot. Because in a superfluid, the dispersion is L, goes to infinity. So this would be a picture which you have at the first order phase transition. But if it's a continuous transition, and that's exactly what we're trying to verify, the distribution is universal, and winding numbers are for the unity, the dispersion is for the unity at the transition point.
May I ask you,
yeah.
T is temperature here?
Yeah.
Does it mean that at zero temperature, stiffness is zero?
I will say it again. Beta is inverse temperature.
Oh. So simply G minus C.
Yeah. Yeah, to have finite rho lambda S, winding numbers have to diverge as L. So we're trying to verify, well, whether this works or it doesn't. You can determine the phase transition point by simply stating, OK, I will look at the transition point by demanding that winding numbers are exactly 1. But then, at the transition point, I can look at the ratio. I'll just show it. So that's how you define the phase transition point. You say the probability to have non-zero winding numbers, which is possible only in the liquid, divided by the probability to have zero winding number is 1. This is good enough definition for the continuous transition point, and it's good enough definition even for first order phase transition point. So this is a good definition for the transition point, no matter the order. Because remember, well, this ratio goes to infinity or to 1. Well, sorry, from infinity to 0 in one of the phases. So if it's 1, it has to be a transition point. And then at this particular point, you simply measure W square average. Because if it's a first order phase transition point, part of the time the system is superfluid, then W square diverges the system size L. Well, if it's second order phase transition, it has to saturate to universal value. It's some number. Basically, you try to verify that once you are at the critical point determined from this condition, so it's roughly saying that the probability to be in a liquid versus the probability to be in a solid is 1. So you're half-half between liquid and solid. And at this particular point, which is critical point, you determine what is the winding number square fluctuations. If they diverge, it's first order. If they saturate to a universal value, it's a continuous phase transition. And now you simply do the analysis of this ratio at the critical point with bigger and bigger system sizes and different charges, different coupling G in the system. And I just will show you the plot. So basically, it's a plot of going along the following leg. We start with very small charge somewhere here and calculate bigger and bigger system sizes, trying to verify whether we have a continuous point or first order point. But at some system size, we have to stop. It's a long-range model. We cannot simulate huge system sizes. So our calculation will be truncated at some length scale. Then we change the coupling constant and again do a series of system sizes, and we have to stop at some system size. But I keep plotting what happens to this parameter, which is expected to saturate to the universal value. For very small coupling, we have to stop at some system size. I think, well, this is roughly 24 cube. We stop here, but this value is exactly U1 cross U1. So if you have U1 cross U1 transition, because if in my action, this point corresponds to no coupling between the fields whatsoever. Here, fields are decoupled. So you have conventional XY transition.
Except for the local coupling, right? There is no vector potential coupling.
In this model, I think even nothing.
No, nothing.
In our model, nothing. So this point is U1 cross U1. There's no coupling between the fields whatsoever. So just one field undergoes normal superfluid transition, and the other field undergoes the same transition because it's symmetric. But there is no coupling between the fields, so it's a trivial point. It's U1 cross U1. And that's where you start this universal constant for very small charge. Because if coupling between the fields is very, very weak, and your system is finite size, even on a system size 24 cube, they don't know about each other. They behave as if it's a conventional transition. So that's what we see here. Well, then we increase system size and go to a system size point, stronger coupling, and calculate a series of system sizes. Then we increase charge, calculate series of system sizes, increase charge, calculate series of system charges, increase coupling. And finally, we see that, well, everything, for whatever reason, well, you are allowed to shift to the scale L with some distance. Basically, this plot verifies the following. The behavior of system on the large scale. So if I start from some bare charge, length scale L, long wave properties are the same as bare charge times some number, L divided by, some other number. It's number one, number two. So there is some length scale which is involved in this transformation. But I simply prove the following, that, well, you can start from small charge, some system size. You can increase charge and take a smaller system size, and you will get exactly the same long wavelength properties. But for slightly bigger charge, I can keep going with this L. And so I keep constructing this plot.
You extract some kind of scaling dimension from these numbers, number one?
Well, one scaling dimension is trivial. It's known that, well, the charge in the model as written undergoes so-called dimensional regularization, well, dimensional enhancement, which means the charge starting from U1 cross U1. It's known that this constant has to grow with scale as G times L, the bare coupling. It's very easy to prove it. You can believe me, or I can just easily derive it with loops. It's a very easy result. So the effective charge on large scale is proportional to L itself.
Rescaling is a property of the U1 cross U1 fixed point?
No, the initial rescaling is the property of U1 cross U1. So that's why initially, forget about, for small g, forget about g squared. So it starts as gl. That's the relevant parameter. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the problem which people have in the...
Charge g proportional to square root of.
No, for small g, it's gl. It simply happens that, well, if I simply write down g squared, the collapse is very good. But after all, I'm perfectly happy to do collapse in this way. It's l divided by some length scale, which is a function of g, whatever it is. Simply for small g, I know that this has to behave as 1 over g. So it takes 1 over g length scale before the model knows it goes to a strong coupling. But that's the problem with deconfined critical action. You can start write down the action, but this action has no perturbative fixed point. You cannot start with small charge and establish something because, well, under the RG flow, the charge goes to strong coupling. And at this point, you just don't know what are the properties of deconfined critical action. Numerically, well, we try to prove the following, that, well, looks like up to some rescaling of distances, it makes no difference whether you calculate small charge up to some scale, or you actually calculate bigger charge on a smaller scale and you keep going, or you increase the charge, and on small scale it will behave exactly the same way as small charge on a much bigger scale. And you keep going, and suddenly here you see it's first order. And because of the data collapse, we claim, well, there is no escape, but the flow, the whole flow goes here, and here you already see the first order phase transition. I'll try to be a little bit short. That's the proof that you have first order phase transition at this point. You simply calculate the probability distribution of how action happens in your simulation. And you see that, well, as the system size gets bigger, bigger, and bigger, you develop two peaks. Well, they're separated by a valley. Well, we cannot go to bigger system size. We have to stop. But we can scale the positions of the peaks. So they do not merge. And basically, nobody knows any other behavior apart from developing first order.
What is S?
S is action.
Action.
In terms of statistical mechanical behavior, it's just like the same as action, energy. So you write down E minus S, so you can read S as E over T in some way, effective. So if it's a bimodal distribution in energy for the classical model, we know it's a first order phase transition. The system wants phase A or phase B, and they have different energies.
So this 0.58, where is it on your previous slide?
Yeah, it's a 0.58. That's how far the flow goes. It's not here. Well, the data continue, but well, that's the point.
If you look at the histogram, say 0.375, what would they look like?
375? You see nothing. You see nothing. The histogram at 375 looks like this. Maybe anomalous flat top, but no, it's one peak.
Just from the histogram, you can't tell what's happening.
No, I can, because, well, you see, it's 0.58. This is system size 20. Well, it's probably this is 24. You just go along this line. 375 finishes here. So probably if I look at 375, for the largest system size, 375 will look like, say, 14. Maybe even flatter. Maybe even just one peak. But it will be kind of anomalous flat top, but one peak. Because the properties on large scale of 375 are the same as properties of 0.58 at a very short scale. But at a very short scale, I don't have the two peaks. At least they're not well developed, and there is no clear separation between them.
So you need to be anomalously weak first order for that 0.375.
No, this is anomalously weak first order, yes. Even for the best case we have, 0.58, it's anomalously weak first order. 32 cube is not yet enough to break the peaks completely. So we cannot even tunnel between them.
You know, large couplings, it's not surprising you're getting first order, right? If you're close to this SFS phase.
But I'm saying that large coupling is no different from small coupling. It's exactly the same master curve.
Yeah, so you need that additional argument to get large coupling.
No, without this argument, there is nothing. If you find first order somewhere, so what? That's exactly the phase diagram where we started from. In the short-range model, you also have a piece of first order. But then there is a tricritical point, and you have a piece of second order. That's what you have in the short-range model. But the short-range model doesn't have the runaway flow.
It's not just
we're just saying that's the property of this long-range model, that you have runaway flow. You start from weak coupling. But necessarily, by runaway, this weak coupling on large scale has to become strong. And when it becomes strong, we see its first order. Because the point here is automatically connected to point here. They are the same on the large scale. It's only up to rescaling distances that's exactly the same property.
So for the second case, if you do the same plot, instead of the data plot, you see a jump or something?
Yeah, I'll show you. Because you see, once you have this phase diagram, tricritical point, your data have to saturate to one value for this line. They have to saturate to another kind of separate tricks for this point, and then they have to start diverging slightly above. So you have to have a divergent flow. Once you have a tricritical point, your data have to behave like this. You saturate to maybe one value, then maybe you start behaving like this, and then you start diverging. Maybe there is some separate tricks which corresponds to the tricritical point itself. But once the data diverge in different ways, you cannot collapse them by shifting horizontally. Because, the only thing which I allow here on the flow gram, if I change the scale here, I can shift the curves in the horizontal way. I cannot shift them vertically. I cannot change their shapes. So the curves collapse only by shifting them horizontally. Once you have this type of flow, no matter that you shift it horizontally, they are at different height. They will never collapse. So that's the signature of the tricritical point. Having this type of collapse is inconsistent with the tricritical point. Basically, it's the claim there is nothing happening between this and this. It's exactly the same behavior all the way.
The qualitative, it's like just below 40 dimensions standard supercomputer.
Yeah, and looks like only one charge is enough to do the collapse. And I'll show you what happens in the... Yeah, this was the question with in the short-range model. That's what you see in the short-range model. Instead of collapse, that's the set of data. So it's exactly the same. In terms of phase diagram, looks almost identical, but there is a tricritical point. If you have a tricritical point, that's what happens close to the tricritical point. Tricritical point is close to 0.5. You cannot collapse this type of data. They're just different height. If I shift them horizontally, nothing. So I would say, that's the proof. We don't have anything else to say about DCP. So the proof is that, small coupling goes to large coupling by the normalization. But at large coupling, you have the first order phase transition. And that's the end of the story.
So you're saying that if I took the 0.125 and went to very big system sizes, I would just go along this line?
That's what we see. No, I'm not saying that's the computer is saying. The computer is saying that if you start with weak charge, you can be deceived by seeing a continuous phase transition. If I take charge 0.25, suppose my microscopic model is the unlucky one. I take 0.25. I simulate system size 100 cube. I see nothing. I don't see the signature of the second order phase transition. I have almost perfect power law scaling of my correlation function. Maybe slightly unusual because, I see some deviations in the power laws because it's not already U1, it's floating somewhere. My critical exponents can be slightly different. But I will never see smoking gun evidence for the first order phase transition because you cannot simulate bigger system size, and that's where you have to stop. And I believe that's what happened during the Scalapina, Melka, and Sandvik calculation of this superfluid valence bond solid transition. Because initially it was the claim of continuous phase transition. Then we did some macroscopic models, found first order, but pretty weak first order. So we start thinking that maybe it's generic behavior, and we switch to simulating the DCP action itself. And meanwhile, Sandvik was trying to run more precisely bigger system sizes to end up with a discontinuous transition. Because this was a problem with the finite size scaling, the critical exponent didn't match, the dynamical critical exponent was enormously low, like 0.25, which is impossible. And so the ultimate result was a discontinuous transition, but that's the trouble. If you start somewhere here with small charge, you basically numerically have no chance to determine first order. You'll see as if it's continuous. You have to construct the flow and to verify how this flow ends. And I would say that, data collapse on this flow gram is a very powerful tool. If you have a tricritical point, everything will just start flying away. You cannot collapse anything. So the signature of the tricritical point is yes or no on this plot. If there is a tricritical point, you will probably see it.
So, unless more recent numerical work in support of it, you can find tricritical point.
I don't know whether this is a work on 0.25.
First of all, it's an O3 semantic case.
Yeah, I know. Well,
so it's completely.
So, I believe we did the job and we finished.
So you think you're in. These two results are not compatible.
No, let me finish. For superfluid valence bond solid transition, I believe it's all. Because so far there is no evidence from microscopic models. It's a continuous transition, that's one. Second, we have an argument that even if you start with sufficiently weak coupling between the spin-ons in the valence bond solid, so you have sufficiently good model, it will still flow to first order. Generically, we say, well, starting from this decoupled point and all the way up, you are closed by first order. Then close to the fork, when the phase transition splits. Well, actually, it splits in this way. It's first order, second order, and second order later. So you have tricritical point here, bicritical point here. So this is bicritical point. Just. This part of the phase diagram is the prediction of the mean field. It has to be first order close to the fork. So it's first order close to the fork. By mean field, all the arguments say it has to be first order, and we show it's first order all the way from the bottom. So we think, well, that's the dead end for the U1 cross U1 symmetry. SU2 symmetry is different. So if you study Niel magnet to valence bond solid transition, it's another symmetry, and we don't have the argument whether it's first order or second order. And but we do exactly the same job. We're constructing flowgrams in the same way, and we try to verify what happens. The model is exactly the same. Because, well, the model of J currents, this one, by slightly modifying it, you can have it in the SU2 symmetric representation. That's what we run. We basically simulate one-to-one the CP1 action on a lattice. It can be done in terms of J currents. Nothing has to be modified. Simply the same analysis has to be repeated. We are not finished yet, so we are not ready to claim that we know the answer.
There are two questions over here, right? One is whether this particular action that you wrote down has a continuous transition or not. The more general question is some other action which has this U1 cross U1 symmetry, now, can that have a generic first continuous transition?
I would say just, well, this action, they never have a continuous phase transition.
Yeah, and
so this is finished.
Then one knows what might be the problem here, right? The fact that you have this fork. Well, as you said, just from mean field theory, you can show that there's going to be a first order transition. Now, that is, so part of your line has got to be first order. The question is, does that first order end or that, you know, at a tricritical point?
Well, the only possibility which you can imagine, I would say, this is the only possibility, but I would say, yeah. Well, nothing can be proved numerically for sure 100%. It's not an exact solution. So the only kind of scenario you can imagine, because this has to be first order for small charge. This has to be first order. It's proved. In any microscopic model, no matter the origin, this is first order. This is proved.
That's from your...
Yeah, we prove that this is always first order. There is no chance. Because it happens on a very large scale. It's irrelevant. Any microscopic details are irrelevant. It's subject to RG on short distances. So it's the ultimate long wave behavior of this action. So this is first order for sure. This has to be first order by mean field. Whether we believe this is possible, I don't.
No, presumably what you need to do is to get rid of this, you know, SFS phase, right?
No, so I don't.
No, if you had a model which didn't have this SFS phase, it would have a longer
It will still be first order. Well, this the behavior here has nothing to do with the fork. It doesn't know about the fork.
Yeah, but you know, you could have a larger line of continuous transitions than if...
Which line?
So, you know, look at your
talk. No, I just don't believe this is ever possible.
No, but, you know, it is a possibility, right?
When I don't know, no.
And if you want to establish that possibility, you'd like to remove the other side.
No, I am saying just, well, whatever charge you have, it will renormalize to strong coupling where fields pair, and it has to be first order. You cannot avoid it because, well, when you start from any charge, you have to make it large. Once you make it large, it's first order. You're done.
It could stop at some intermediate coupling.
But, well, that's what our results prove. It doesn't stop at intermediate coupling. It goes first order.
There are two questions here. One is for this particular model that you looked at, and one is more general. If you wanted to find a model where you have a better chance of seeing a continuous transition if it exists. Right? So you ask the question, how should I modify my...
Okay, I can say, okay. In terms of field theory, we're done. So this field theory, or this field theory, or this field theory, especially this one, it has no first order phase transition, period. Maybe. Maybe. No, no. No. Everything happens on a very large scale. Our lattice is completely irrelevant for the transition we see, because first order we see on 32 cube, any microscopic details, completely irrelevant. People see first order here, here, and here, and in all microscopic models we know. First order has nothing to do with details on a microscopic scale.
It depends where you cross the phase boundary.
Unfortunately, all the evidence we have is you need more than 24 cube sites to see the evidence of first order. It's never strong. So it's irrelevant what is the microscopic detail. It's subject to the RG.
It doesn't matter exactly where you cross the boundary. Let's say you have
the position of the boundary, yes. But the nature of the line being first order, no, it's robust. It's the property of this action. Whenever you have this action, it has first order.
But you know, I can add terms to this action, right? To move.
Which ones? Psi 4, Psi 6, Psi 8?
Sure, I mean, this is a bad action. I could add anything.
No? Well, you can prove yourself, as you know. Just if I start with this action with small U1 cross U1, we'll say Psi 6, Psi 8, irrelevant. So on line.
Strongly interacting fixed point, right? It's not like it's at its upper critical dimension. Where
okay, I'm not saying that any field action which one can possibly write has a first order phase transition. No, some field actions probably have a continuous point, but this one doesn't. That's all I'm saying. This one doesn't. Maybe you have a better idea of some other field action.
That's what I'm suggesting, right? What you need to do is to get rid of this pairing. And you know, there are obvious terms you can write down.
No, pairing, for us, pairing is not important. It's first order all the way close to zero charge. They pair because it's a runaway flow to first order. It's the property of the continuous limit of this model. Go to first order runaway flow. It has nothing to do with the fork.
He's saying when you take, when you don't, have, not for weak charge, but if you take a model with large charge, you
then
good first order fork because it's of its proximity to the fork, where you even in mean field you have a first order transition. If you could separate those two, then you could have a region of very large charge where the mean field first order transition.
I perfectly understand.
During first order, but then there's a tricritical point.
I perfectly understand this.
You could separate these.
And I'm saying that the mean field is not predicting that the first order goes all the way. The mean field says, well, it has to stop somewhere and it becomes a continuous line. Mm-hmm. What this deconfined critical action does, it simply eliminates this part. It eliminates this part in a generic way. Whether you have this part or not, it doesn't matter.
How do you know they have to connect? They don't have to connect.
That's what I'm saying. I already said. I cannot prove numerically that this is not possible. But nobody so far has presented anything saying this is possible. So I would say just, okay, yeah, we can keep guessing whether this does exist or it doesn't. I cannot prove this is not possible.
But to maximize the chances of that, what you'd like to do is to move this fork up, right?
No, as far as I understand, it doesn't help because, well, this is generically true, and you just run away here, and I believe this is never happening. This is my belief. I'm saying not, it's not a proof. My belief, this is not possible.
No, but to strengthen that belief, if you like, what you'd like to do is add some term that disfavors pairing, right, which you can do in that.
I would say you can try add this term and simulate, because, well, but what can I say? We say, well, there is some action which probably does this. First, find it at least in the mean field level that it does. So far, I didn't see anything, even at the mean field level, that this is possible.
So let me say that you need to use some terms, so you get rid of this. And if you still find the same scenario, then I think that means things.
Yeah.
So you're clear, right?
In fact, we know what term to add, right? You want a term with the opposite sign hopping for pairs. You know, thing that would disfavor pair hopping. And that'll add to,
I think it will not help. Again, well, it will not help because everything happens on a huge scale. Local, if you think in terms of local interactions, loops don't pair locally. They ignore each other locally. They pair on a scale which is 30. Yes, good luck, you can write down a Hamiltonian which involves 30 currents at the same time to make sure that on a length scale which involves 1,000 sites, you see, on a short scale, there is no pairing. It's a weak coupling. They don't even know about each other at short distance. They don't pair at short distance. They pair only on a scale 30. Yes, you can prohibit behavior on a scale 30, but it's a very hard Hamiltonian to write. On a short scale, nothing will help because we see nothing on a short scale. It's conventional U1 cross U1. You'll have conventional cross one, U1 cross U1, fine, on a short distance.
Let me imagine adding another axis to your phase diagram.
Yeah.
Now, you've simulated the action with, say, zero for this pair hopping, that disfavors pair hopping term.
And let's say you find first order everywhere. Now, if you move along this axis, it's entirely possible that the phase diagram changes, right?
Possibly.
That this line is no longer completely first order, and you know this phase gets pushed up and open up a region of continuous transition.
I don't believe.
No, but how can you eliminate that possibility?
I already told you. I cannot add anything. I'm just saying, well, starting from the origin, it's first order, and they pair here on very large scale when microscopic details are irrelevant. The pairing is something which happens in this action on very large scale. Whatever you say about microscopic behavior but has no influence.
Very large scales for that parameter being small, zero.
Whether you believe
the parameter large, then it's
I already told you, well, if this happens, there is no theoretician to prove this is possible. It's only for someone each time running a simulation for a particular model. Because if you say all parameters are for the unity, who is going to do the job? Analytically, you will never prove this is possible. We cannot prove that, well, Ising transition is continuous. H divided by J, everything is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Ising model has to be done numerically to prove it's a continuous transition. Because, well, basically I'm saying, well, by doing this, what we have proved, you lose the possibility to do any perturbative calculation. Now you claim that somewhere in the region of strong parameters, everything is strong. You cannot do any analytical calculation at this point. Maybe there is a hiding, a piece of second order phase transition. Who is going to do the job?
No, but you're simply saying that's impossible, right?
No, I already said what that's my belief. I say I do not prove this is not possible. I don't believe it's possible.
Can we wrap up the conclusion?
The conclusion is here. I say, well, I don't believe this is possible. That's the conclusion. But it's my belief. I cannot prove it.
So why don't we continue our discussions afterwards? The first thing, Nicole,
But it has to be this scenario. It cannot be otherwise. But I cannot say I can prove it. No, I can't.
But you can test it.
No, I can't.